Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Eliot Spitzer is a big figure in American politics, in New York State, and now in the story of prostitution. America's sex industry, sex for sale, tends to be huge and quiet. This week, it's huge in the news and loud. So what's it look like, and who gets hit when prostitution meets the law? This hour, On Point, we'll dig in from streetwalkers to $5,000 escorts to look at Eliot Spitzer, America's sex industry, and the law. Joining me first today from Albany, New York, is Joel Stashenko. He's Albany Bureau Chief for the New York Law Journal. He's been following all the news on Eliot Spitzer, and that news is hot and furious today. Joel, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Well, I'm good. We'll have some people listening to this live, some who will hear it later. As we speak, the news is coming out that Eliot Spitzer is expected to resign today. What does a resignation mean for this very prominent political figure in American life? An end to his political career?
I think you have to assume that his political career is over. I know some people have managed to survive even these sorts of sordid allegations and charges, but given how he rose to power here in New York as the crusading sheriff of Wall Street and the ethical master, or he tried to be, who was going to come in and clean up Albany, few people could see how he could survive.
And then,
once these allegations happened.
And then, Joel, what about Eliot Spitzer's potential criminal liability here? Where does it lie?
I think people may be surprised that prosecutors would have, if they tried to press these allegations that have surfaced so far, would have some pretty severe difficulties in getting, you know, really serious charges brought against him and to convict him of the same sorts of charges.
Now, what do you mean have difficulty getting serious charges? In many states, if you're the John, the client, the person hiring the prostitute, it's just a misdemeanor. Nevertheless, to be convicted of having done that isn't pretty on anybody's record, so... Do you consider misdemeanor no big deal? Would he be charged with that even if it doesn't rise to some higher rank of criminal charge?
Well, I'll tell you the way it works in New York. What he is, I'm sure, has been very mindful of throughout this whole process is if he's going to have to lose the governorship, which is a horrible punishment to pay for anybody, he wants to hold on to his law license. I mean, he is a lawyer, and that's an important thing to have.
That's
going
his
forward
trade.
If he's going to salvage the rest of his life.
Mm-hmm.
And a conviction for prostitution, soliciting a prostitute in New York under the judicial attorney disciplinary canons, does not mean disbarment. And in fact, my colleagues here yesterday and today have been talking to people familiar with this, and we think that his actions for prostitution, for instance, would be a borderline between private admonition and a public censure as far as his legal license is concerned.
Now, is there a scenario in which law enforcement might work up the ladder and bring heavier charges to him, and what could they be?
Yes, there are two main charges, two more serious charges, are possibilities, we think. One is a charge for what's called structuring, which is an attempt to break up money, essentially, so it cannot be traced.
So this gets into a banking violation rather than anything to do with prostitution specifically.
Exactly.
And this gets to the reports now that as much as $80,000 may have flowed from Eliot Spitzer to the Emperor's Club. We've had these reports of chunks of $5,000, $5,000, $4,300, a fair amount of money. What's the crime or potential crime there?
Well, the problem with prosecuting that, we're told by legal experts who are familiar with these kinds of cases, is that they almost are always brought when the money is dirty, so to speak, when there's an attempt to launder money, and that is not the case, apparently, with Mr. Spitzer.
We read that the initial suspicion, the flagging of this money, and there's a lot of surveillance going on of where money moves, and here's proof of it, was that it might have been to do with political corruption. Describe for us what is known about where the money came from, and Elliot Spitzer's finances. He makes something like $179,000 as New York governor. Where would this kind of money come from in his case?
Well, I think the joke, it may not be a joke, but the idea in Albany that Elliot Spitzer would have to worry about money is kind of humorous. His family is worth $1 billion.
His father, a real estate baron.
One of the most wealthy ones in New York City. So the money itself never seemed to be an issue in anybody's minds here. However, last year, a bank reported him for making a transfer of $10,000 or in excess of $10,000, and that triggers a report to the federal government by the bank under the Bank Security Act. So the IRS begins to look at this transfer and what happens to what was happening with his accounts. And their first suspicion was that he was either on the take somehow or was being blackmailed, even.
Though that's not what has come out here. It's another story entirely. You're describing a scenario in which there might be no criminal charges here. Interesting, Elliot Spitzer himself was in the forefront of a move to toughen up on prostitution laws in New York just in his short term already as governor, Joel.
Just last year. He signed the human trafficking law, which stiffened some of the penalties for convictions for clients of prostitutes.
That would now, it appears, be, or allegedly anyway, though not in New York State. In this instance, Elliot Spitzer himself, he is now expected to appear within an hour and a half or so of the time we're talking live, Joel. He may be on his way out as governor of New York. Joel Stashenko with the New York Law Journal. Thank you very much for joining us from Albany today.
Thank you.
Joining me now from San Francisco is Melissa Farley. She's director of the nonprofit group Prostitution Research and Education. She's studied prostitution worldwide. The U.S. State Department called on her in its anti-trafficking work. Her findings for them were published last year in the book Prostitution and Trafficking in Nevada, Making the Connections. Melissa Farley, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, glad to be here.
And with us from New York is Eugene O'Donnell, professor of law and police studies at John Jay College of Criminal Justice at City University of New York. He's a former New York police detective who has worked as a prosecutor in Brooklyn and Queens. Eugene O'Donnell, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Melissa Farley, first to you. You've written just today it's the clients who get off and they shouldn't. What do you see unfolding in the Elliot Spitzer story?
I think it's critical to look at the woman in this scenario. There's been huge concern for his life, his career, and certainly this is a tragedy for anti-trafficking activists in the state of New York who worked closely with him to develop the new anti-trafficking law that as Mr. Stashenko said, they go after traffickers and go after the men who create the demand, which is in this case Mr. Spitzer.
Who they were calling a hero very recently for his work in going after trafficking.
It's exactly, and it's the kind of hypocrisy that's common, and it certainly makes us all wonder, how many men in the United States are Johns anyway? Is it almost everyone? Is it 50% of men? When you look at the kinds of prostitution that are mainstreamed all over the United States, in strip clubs, in escort agency, on Craigslist, on the internet, it's every place. And it's not just, as people used to think, someone standing on the street. It's indoors today. It's in massage parlors, saunas, health clubs, and so-called high-priced escort agencies, which in truth are very much like any other kind of prostitution.
It may have boiled down to the same old thing, though the money clearly is high. Eugene O'Donnell, you've been on the law enforcement side of this. You heard Joel Stashenko saying in New York State, the soliciting a prostitute doesn't mean necessarily disbarment for a lawyer like Elliot Spitzer. I mean, traditionally there has been, has there not, a kind of ambivalence among police, you know, how hard to go after this?
Well, all policing is local. So just in New York State, you have hundreds of police departments. Depending on what part of the state you're in, obviously, these could be big issues. But in a city like New York or some of the bigger cities, the police strategy tends to be based on the demand of the public. If there's a hue and cry about a prostitution problem, you'll see police enforcement. Other than that, there tends to be not so much enforcement. Interestingly, you know, in the United States, probably 20 times more arrests in the United States based on the Uniform Crime Report for drug offenses, for example, than for prostitution. So very much an issue that law enforcement deals with based usually on complaints and usually on patterns that really can't be ignored.
Eugene O'Donnell, you were a policeman, a detective, a cop. Are you surprised at the Elliot Spitzer case, at a John of this stature?
Well, I think what's interesting now in law enforcement is we're going to see more and more people backing into criminal conduct because of the use of technology. So more people with text messaging, emails, credit cards, more people that the people that law enforcement was not looking for initially.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at America's sex industry and the law, from back streets to pricey escort services, who gets prosecuted, and the fate of New York Governor Elliot Spitzer. Headlines coming out now saying he's expected to resign today. By the time you hear this, he may already have resigned. We don't know exactly what's going to unfold there. We're joined today by Melissa Farley from San Francisco, longtime clinical psychologist and director of prostitution research and education. Also by Eugene O'Donnell, joining us from New York, professor of law and police studies at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, former NYPD detective and prosecutor in Brooklyn and Queens. Melissa Farley, I don't know if it's possible to do this, but can you kind of paint a picture of how, I know you look at pornography as well, and we've talked a lot about that, but here we're focused on really head-on prostitution. What is the shape of that industry, if we can call it that, in the United States today? How much is escort service? How much is on the streets? We'll ask Eugene O'Donnell about how people arrange it, but how's it migrating? Where is it?
Well, I mean, most people look at the person in prostitution as some kind of commodity, as a thing. Even in the coverage of this event, people are rarely looking at what her experience is. And I've spent a decade studying what women and men and children in prostitution actually happens to them. What we know happens to them is, first, they all want to get out of prostitution. They are not, according to the myth, happy hookers. They would rather, just like you and me, be doing something else for a living. Secondly, whether it's indoors or outdoors, legal or illegal, it causes acute emotional distress to be sexually servicing 5 to 8 to 10 anonymous strangers a day and engaging in acts that most of us consider extremely intimate.
But is that what we're talking about here? I can imagine people thinking with this Emperor's Club, you know,
$5,000,
$50,000 for 3 days.
$5 really doesn't make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
The experience emotionally is the same. And women and men who describe it as renting an organ for 10 minutes, it doesn't feel particularly good to be a rented organ. And that's what prostitution feels like, even if it's at the Emperor's Club. Pimps would have you think that's a high price escort, and Johns the world over believe that it's different from on the street. It isn't. Pimps still take their 50% cut. They still demand 2 sex acts an hour, as we read in the affidavit in the Spitzer case. It's pretty much the same thing with a marketing spin on it.
Eugene O'Donnell, when you read down through the Elliot Spitzer case as a former police detective, what strikes you about it? Does this look like sort of run-of-the-mill, high-priced sex for sale or something different? Is this common?
Well, I think the Elliot Spitzer case ultimately will not turn out to be a prostitution case. It may turn out politically to be a prostitution case, but the more serious concerns he has would surround the issues of structuring and financial fraud, because that really speaks more to the corruption of the office, the idea that somebody who prosecuted people for scams and for scheming was himself enmeshed in that stuff. I think that will ultimately be a bigger problem for him. I think what strikes me is that it's an unusual event when federal prosecutors, there's hardly any federal prosecution that doesn't cost hundreds of thousands of dollars to undertake. It's a pretty unusual event when federal prosecutors are stepping into court, prosecuting somebody or referring to somebody with reference to a consensual sexual act among adults. That just doesn't happen a lot.
And here we've got a wiretap. We've got the words of the prostitute herself, worried about what she's going to be asked to do. Saying what she's being told by the switchboard at the Emperor's Club, she might be asked to do things that you might not think were safe.
Women in prostitution are always worried about that, and really the most progressive laws that we know today are laws that focus in on the actual transaction that happens, that target the buyers and decriminalize the woman herself in prostitution. The Swedes have put this law into effect that actually levies felony-level arrests at all men who buy sex. And as a result of that law in Sweden, they've pretty much stopped all trafficking into the country, because one of the first things we learn about prostitution and trafficking is that you don't have one without the other. They always go together. So if New York State is attempting to stop trafficking, as all of us are in the U.S., and everyone seems to be concerned about that, we have to address the root of the problem, which is the John's demand for purchase sex, i.e. escort prostitution.
Eugene O'Donnell, what's your experience? Who gets prosecuted when the law finally does come into a prostitution case?
Well, clearly, if there was an element of this that involved trafficking, that is to say there was any hint at all that this was against the will of the prostitute, and I understand what Melissa's saying completely, but just in a standard prosecutorial mindset, if somebody's being coerced or brought across state lines against their will, that would clearly get on the radar screen of the U.S. Attorney's Office, I suspect, and would be a much bigger deal. The problem you have with vice enforcement that makes it different than criminal enforcement at the end of the day is that whereas crimes usually happen to people that are not willing to be victimized, in this particular situation, with the problem you have with vice is you have people that are going out seeking the service. And that's the hard part about gambling enforcement, drug enforcement, prostitution enforcement.
Are you saying the prostitute is seeking the encounter or
The client is seeking it. I mean, ordinarily what you have with law enforcement is you have somebody who's robbed or has something taken from them, and obviously it's against their will. But in this paradigm, you're trying to stop a crime where people are seeking the service, and that's a much more difficult equation.
In your experience as a policeman, as a detective, what's the ratio of charges against prostitutes versus their clients? How often do they face the law, the consequences versus those paying?
Well, the problem is, as always, you usually get the low-level folks. You get the people that are on the street, and street-level prostitutes tend to be a sad group of people more than a bad group of people, drug problems and the like. And they end up often being targeted, although increasingly law enforcement is experimenting with name and shame campaigns where they put billboards up or they notify loved ones or notify community members that somebody's been arrested. So there's been some effort to balance it out. The one thing I think the research shows is that the John is probably easier deterred ultimately than the prostitute, because it's the John that bears the embarrassment and is more frightened about exposure than the prostitute.
Though Melissa Farley asked today, what about the woman in this case, the Spitzer case, what's she going through now? Is she in danger from organized crime? Is anybody offering her legal counsel or alternatives?
I think Eugene brings up an important issue that's in everyone's mind, which is, was there force? Was there coercion? And we have to look at the bigger picture. What are the forces that channel women into prostitution? Probably, and it looks like she didn't have any kind of gun to her head to be involved in this. But what was
she came down on train on her own volition, as far as we can see, to Washington from New York.
As far as we can see. But yeah. What were the forces that got her into that escort agency and on that train? Was she trying to pay the rent, tuition? Did she have a history of childhood sexual abuse, which we know 85% of those in prostitution, high-end or low-end, have? Was she? Did she experience a lack of educational and job opportunities because of racism in the United States? And at the bottom line, is there sex inequality in her life and in her education? Because that's at the root of prostitution. When men are poor, they don't prostitute. They sell pencils. When women are poor, it's assumed they'll sell sex. And I think that's at the heart of it. Are we really serious about offering women, and especially women who are marginalized because of race or ethnicity, do we really want to offer them safe housing, meals for their kids, educational and job opportunities? Those are the big factors that create the setting for the success of the pimps that ran the Emperor's Club.
Big questions behind a big industry. Let's go to our callers from Savannah, Georgia. Jonathan, you're on the air.
Sorry. Yes, how are you doing? I had a question for the guests. Basically, is there a difference between the people that go into just strictly escorting services versus the prostitution rings? And is there a difference between the people that decided that, because in like the brothels in Utah, they're legal, I believe, and aren't they going in there free-handed? They're not being forced into that business. They're going in there seeking a job,
right,
versus the ones that are illegal.
Melissa...
Great question.
Mm-hmm. Melissa?
Absolutely great question. One of the myths about prostitution is that there are these compartments that people go into. They're either working on the street, in a legal brothel, in an illegal brothel or massage parlor. None of that is true. Women move to where the market exists, and that could be in a massage parlor, at a political convention, at a sports event. They may go into street prostitution. In Nevada, 50% of the people working in the legal brothels have also worked in illegal street and strip club prostitution.
Jonathan, let me ask you, do you see a difference between escort services and straight-up old-fashioned street walking or any other kind of prostitution?
Well, from my understanding, there's a legitimate thing called for escort services that are non-sexual, where, you know, someone needs, you know, like in Law and Order, they go to New York or something like that, a businessman or something, and they need a companion for a business trip, and, you know, they need that company.
So you're imagining that side of it. Let us ask Eugene O'Donnell, give us a reality check here. You know the world pretty well. We see these page after page on the internet or in papers of escort service. Should we just assume that most of that is essentially prostitution?
Probably, but I think what we're starting to hear in this conversation really is another example where we think the criminal justice system is gonna save us, is gonna fix all of this, and it's not. And
why not? What do you mean?
Well, because ultimately these are issues that deal with education and attitudes. These are societal issues, economic issues. And it's not unusual now to see the criminal justice system being used sort of as a catch-all for insoluble problems or extremely difficult problems. I mean, if you took the alcohol abusers, the drug abusers, the mental health people, the people who were sexually abused, who were in prison, out of prison would be empty. The common denominator, a lot of this, is a much more complicated issue than just locking people up and putting them behind bars.
Are you expressing there an ambivalence or communicating an ambivalence in law enforcement itself about going after prostitution? What's the use? It starts elsewhere. It's a bigger problem than the law can really address?
Yeah, and also, if you talk to law enforcement officers, the other reason they're ambivalent is inevitably, inexorably, their involvement often ends up with them being corrupted and them having issues around these issues. So law enforcement likes to try to stay at arm's length from these cases, if at all possible, because, as with all vice enforcement, the oldest history in law enforcement is law enforcement and vice equals temptation, corruption, financial issues, and serious potential for problems.
Let's go to Lisa calling from Boston. Hi, Lisa. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I had wanted to piggyback on what Ms. Farley had talked about. I run a prostitution prevention initiative here in Boston. We have the opportunity to do work nationally as well. And I just wanted to talk a little bit about the women and girls who are in prostitution who are exploited in this way. We know that the average age of recruitment, both here in Boston and nationally, is 13 to 16 years old. And that pimps specifically target young girls who, as Melissa talked about, have a history of sexual abuse, are in our state care, are living in group homes, lockup facilities, are on the run and in a bus station. They'll look for the loneliest girl, the girl most in need, and that's who they deceive, manipulate, coerce to pull in. And it's these girls who then become women who are in prostitution, that they're not two separate populations. They're vulnerable girls who get coerced and pulled in, who are then beaten and raped and kept in, so that it may look that someone of her own free will gets on a train and goes to meet a trick. But I've had adult women survivors talk to me about being miles and miles away from their pimp and feeling like he was looking right over their shoulder, of wiring money back to him because they were so afraid. So there's no way to know the level of coercion or fear this woman was under. And even if she wasn't, we need to remember that the vast majority of women and girls are.
So what do you think when you see the Elliot Spitzer case about Elliot Spitzer? He was Attorney General. He's brought in laws in New York as governor to be tougher on trafficking. How do you think about this case, this powerful man, and what we're learning, apparently, about what he's done?
You know, I don't think about it any differently than Melissa Farley does in terms of a trick is a trick. And there's lots of powerful folks. I mean, we know, we estimate that between 100 and 300,000 young people at any given time over the course of a year are exploited in this country. So if for kids, they're mandated to do anywhere from 8 to 20 tricks a night by their pimp. So if you do the math, you can only imagine the number of adults and predominantly adult men paying to have sex with children, no less paying to have sex with adult women.
Melissa Farley, do you see a movement to make the law tougher, to change the focus of it in this country, to really go after prostitution and the sex business, or an attitude that it will always be with us and on we go?
I certainly do. I mean, I think Mr. Spitzer has betrayed not only his wife and three teenage daughters and the women who worked for an anti-trafficking bill in the state of New York. He has betrayed all women, including prostituted and trafficked women. I think, to get back to the law enforcement question, I think, first of all, we need good laws that really say that really go after the demand. But right behind that, we do need, as Mr. O'Donnell said, we need public education. And just as we found in the movement to end battering against women, talking and counseling alone does not do it. We'll keep doing that. We'll keep talking about the harm, the violence, the exploitation, the commodification of women, but we need laws to back it up. We found out that counseling and talking did not stop men from battering.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about prostitution and the law in America, from back streets to pricey escort services. Who gets prosecuted, and the fate of New York Governor Elliot Spitzer? Melissa Farley has joined us from San Francisco with prostitution research and education there, a nonprofit. Eugene O'Donnell has joined us from New York, professor of law and police studies at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, former NYPD detective and prosecutor in Brooklyn and Queens. Eugene O'Donnell, Melissa Farley is talking about cracking down harder But you're saying, you know, and we've seen it in the Spitzer case, that with the prostitutes and pimps are using new technology to do business, but the law has also got a bigger technology reach than ever, and more people are likely to get caught up in the law enforcement net because of that, as in the Spitzer case. What do you see coming? What's happening?
Well, I just want to just go back to the previous caller. While law enforcement may in some places be frustrated and maybe even resigned to the prostitution with adults, I'm not aware of many police officers or police departments that wouldn't take the exploitation of a child extremely seriously. So if a 13 or 14-year-old child was being abused, okay. I think most police departments, that would be a very serious issue indeed. I think what law enforcement is faced with, again, is they're overtasked. And if you work down the list of offenses, crimes that they have to deal with, prostitution, you know, is not dead last, but it's way down at the bottom. They have to deal with robbery and homicide and very serious offenses. They have a resource issue. And some of these cases are expensive to make and expensive to prosecute. And so there are some of the obstacles that are involved. And what is the deterrent effect? In many cases I was involved with as a prosecutor in New York City, you know, you'd see a prostitute come in and you'd look at their rap sheet and it was many, many reoffending. They reoffended often. So, and what do you do? Fine somebody? If you find somebody at that point, they're most likely to go out and secure the fine money by continuing to do what they were doing when
but
they got
arrested.
But
you're saying on the client side that the net is going to get wider, that law enforcement with a touch of a button now can connect all kinds of dots, as in the case of Elliot Spitzer's cash flow, that may be catching people up.
Yeah, but the question is going to be whether they're going to want to act on all of that. I think even in the child exploitation case, I think a few years ago in England, or it could have been U.S. I think it might have been U.S. Customs, did a child exploitation case, and it literally involved tens of thousands of people. And when those referrals were made across the world, in some countries, they just didn't have the resources to pursue that serious offense. You can just imagine.
Right. The issue is enforcement. I mean, one place we could start is simply by enforcement of existing laws, where in most states, in Boston, in New York, prostitution is a criminal offense, period. Let's start arresting Johns, even if they're not the level of arrest I would like to see. That's a place to start.
But let me ask you, Eugene O'Donnell, though, Melissa, if I may. Eugene, you were a policeman, a detective, a prosecutor, and yet you've said, you know, I mean, I wonder what you're thinking when you look at the Spitzer case. You've said if you're a good cop, you become humane, you get a little less judgmental. I mean, somewhere, are you saying a good cop looks at this as a matter of human nature and doesn't go crazy about it? Or what's the implication?
I think cops deserve to be represented as the, you know, the vast different group of people that they are. But I think that any kind of vice enforcement over a long period of time can wear people down, because the idea that you're going to stop this activity, you know, is probably wishful thinking, at least in the short run. And so law enforcement is not real enthused. I just want to correct the record. I was not a detective. I wasn't an NYPD officer.
Excuse me.
Not a detective.
Excuse me on that. Let's take a call from Heidi in Nashville, Tennessee. Heidi, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I was to that point that your guest just made, actually. You've been talking earlier about needing more laws and more enforcement. And, you know, when we criminalize prostitution, which, as we all know, is the oldest profession in the world, we create a market for it. And if we were to legalize it, we could control it and maybe make it safer and know what's going on with it. And I just wondered if your guest had any comments on
but
that.
But isn't there a market, I guess, sadly, for sex for money, whether it's legal or illegal? I mean, why does you think the fact that it's illegal makes it more attractive?
Men, historians and economists and law enforcement have been attempting to deal with men's sexual incontinence since the Middle Ages. There is a big assumption that it's impossible for men to contain themselves sexually. I actually am more optimistic than that.
Since the Middle Ages is a long time, that's quite a record of evidence. Is it incontinence or nature?
A lot of evidence of incontinence, but I'm still hopeful that men are going to be able to change that.
Let's go to Bella in Hubbardston, Massachusetts. Bella, you're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi.
I tend to feel that it's the pimping that needs to be stomped on hard, because you know, as long as history's been, you know. Girl meets nice-looking caveman. They go exchange, have nice haunch of mastodon, and go back into the back of the cave. Nothing wrong with that. And temples of Astarte had temple prostitution where it was sacred. But where you get a third person making money off of these two people's orgasm, taking a cut, then that is what is really wrong. That's what drives the snakeheads bringing in shipping containers.
What about going after the clients, those who buy the service, Bella? What about that impulse?
This has always been, you know, a gentleman might meet a woman somewhere and take her out and give her a dinner and a piece of jewelry and then be expecting to go up to a hotel room, which he pays for. What's different from him just giving her the C-note? What's wrong is when Bozo, off in the background, threatens the lady with harm or mayhem if she doesn't kick back $75 out of that $100.
I'm sure Melissa Farley will see it differently, but I want to bring another voice into this conversation. And Bella, thanks for your call. Let's go to New York again. And Juhu Tukral, director of the Sex Workers Project at the Urban Justice Center in New York City. Ms. Tukral, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So the Elliot Spitzer case has sort of set off a firestorm, people thinking about prostitution, the sex industry, our laws, and where the weight of the law should fall. You spend a lot of time thinking about people who are in this business, and what do you think about it? Should the law be going after clients more severely than it does now? Should it be going after sex workers harder than it does now?
Well, you know, here's the thing. Spitzer actually pushed through legislation that we and, you know, many other groups had been working on for the last few years to address trafficking in New York State, and it just became law last fall.
Right.
He and his office really pushed this one penalty enhancement for clients, and so that it went from being a B misdemeanor in New York State to an A misdemeanor, and we actually opposed that. A number of our allies did as well. So, you know, it's a little ironic now that, you know, all of this news, these allegations have come out.
Why wouldn't you want a tougher approach toward clients of prostitutes?
Because, you know, it's actually quite counterproductive. I mean, if the goal here is to help people who are working in prostitution, we want them to feel safe coming forward when they're victims of violence. We represent people who are in prostitution, women, adolescents, boys. I think earlier somebody was saying that men don't sell their, you know, they don't get involved in prostitution when they need money, and that's not the case. We have many, many male clients. But what we find is that when they are victims of violence, they are terrified to come forward. It's very, very hard for them to believe that the police will take them seriously. And often when we take cases to the police, unless it's a trafficking case, the police are really not interested.
But Melissa Farley says if you don't crack down on demand, you can't get a handle on this. And cracking down on demand means going after those who buy the services of prostitutes.
Well, actually what it's doing is driving people further underground. This is already a very shadowy world because it's against the law in most states. There's just such an enormous amount of stigma where people are afraid that their families will find out. You know, one arrest can really derail someone's life. If they're an immigrant, they could lose their legal status. If they are looking for alternative employment, or actually a lot of our clients have jobs that are in the mainstream.
And when you say your clients, you mean sex workers, as you call them.
Yes. Our clients who are sex workers, they are often doing this work because they need the money. They don't have that many options available to them that are really going to pay a living wage.
But do you see this industry as a travesty, as Melissa does, a kind of a vast expression of all kinds of injustices or early childhood abuse or something else?
No, I think that, you know, it's a very different perspective. And for us, what we see this as is economic issues are the main drivers for us. I mean, we've done two studies on sex workers in New York, one on people who are working on the street, another on people who are working indoors. And for both of those groups, we, you know, one question that we asked is, have you made a living wage in other jobs that you had? And two-thirds of the respondents in both studies said no. And then we asked, well, what were the other jobs that you had? And it was things like waitressing or, you know, being a sales clerk, retail sort of things, or even office jobs. People are not making enough money to get by. And so, you know, they hear about this. Somebody will tell them, well, this is what I do and this is how I've made extra money. And they get into that work.
But isn't that an equity issue then? Or are you just saying give them a break? They need to eat. They need to make enough money to put food on the table?
There are much deeper rooted economic issues. And I think that is something that applies to so many people. I mean, the majority of our clients are getting into this because they're saying, I can't make enough money doing other things. And so that's one question that we keep asking is, why are we not able to provide jobs that actually pay living wage, that pay, you know, decent health insurance benefits, that kind of thing? Because that's a really key.
Melissa, I'm sure you'll want to respond to that. Let me get one call first. Joe in Boston. Joe, you're on the air.
Thank you. I think prostitution is great, and I've used them in...
Have you been one, Joe? Have you been one? Have you been a prostitute?
I have been a prostitute. I've used them. In Nevada, where they were legal, it was a wonderful experience. In Amsterdam, and I think that the idea... I remember asking a friend, why is it there are prostitutes for men, but not so much for women? The sex feels just as good for each one.
Are you so sure? How was it for her in Nevada?
Well, let me finish the line, because I think it betrays everything.
Yeah.
When I said, why is it that this is for men? And he said, you don't understand. Women have a choice. They can say yes or no. Men can only say yes. And I think that there would be a lot more sex crime if it wasn't for the outlet that prostitution gives to people. There are men who cannot... whose wives won't satisfy them, or who are unmarried, or for whatever reason they can't make it with women normally. This gives them an outlet and a safe one, and there would be less disease, and the girls would get much better pay and benefits if they were legal like they are in Nevada.
So you're saying...
This is such a hypocrisy. It's like the stupid war on drugs, trying to prevent something that's just human nature.
Joe, we hear it. You're saying, let's legalize. Thanks for your call. Melissa Farley, let's come to you. You hear what Joe says.
I think we know now that in Amsterdam, which is the classic example of legal prostitution, the city council members and the mayor are in the process of shutting down the legal brothels, because what's happened is they've brought in exactly the kind of organized crime that is behind the Emperor's Club, which Mr. Spitzer was involved in. You don't have any kind of prostitution without pimps and without organized crime. They're attracted to it. And you also have trafficking, where you have legal prostitution. People think that legal prostitution is typical in Nevada. 90% of prostitution in the state of Nevada is illegal prostitution. So it's counterintuitive, but where you have legal prostitution, it actually increases illegal prostitution, because it sends out a legal welcome to pimps and traffickers the world over. We know this from Australia and also the Netherlands.
Jude Tuchrell, how do you look at legalization of it? Do you go as far as advocating that or not?
Well, our position is really that arresting people is not helpful to them, because, again, people who are involved in prostitution, if they're trying to get out and find a job, having even an arrest and, you know, much less a conviction for prostitution is really going to be devastating to their job consequences. I mean, we've had clients who have been at risk for eviction when they were arrested for prostitution. You know, the idea here, again, is there's this very wide net of problems that people may or may not be facing. I mean, we talk to sex workers every day because they're our clients and we represent them. And they have different problems, some of which are very similar to those that people in other jobs have, and others that are very unique to their situation. And the problem with putting people in a situation where they're going to get arrested is that they're going to go further underground, and it means that they are harder to reach when they need help. About a quarter of our clients about a quarter of our clients are victims of human trafficking, and we represent them in all sorts of ways. And the thing is that a lot of them are terrified of coming forward, even though there's a law that really specifically protects them here in the U.S. Because they are afraid of the police. They're you know, terrified that they're going to be deported.
Eugene O'Donnell, you've been in law enforcement there in New York. Now here falls Elliot Spitzer, a big guy in the middle of a prostitution scandal. Do you see this likely changing New York law further or laws around the country further? Do you think we'll see some kind of reaction to this that will change essentially the way America looks at deals with prostitution legally, or same old, coming more?
That'd be a good time for reflection. I think the one thing you learn as a cop is that everybody's for law enforcement until it happens to them. And maybe we should sort of, you know, rethink a lot of our focus, which really, and I think both of your guests, certainly the Urban Justice Institute, would concur with what my view, which is that the law enforcement heavy emphasis on this, you know, ultimately is counterproductive. It's a much bigger issue. It is an economic issue. There's issues of racism, exploitation. A lot of the people that are end up in this business were exploited, abused. The child protection system is an issue. There are much larger issues, you know, and so it would be a good time to reflect that when we do finger pointing, sometimes the finger pointing should come full circle in some respects.
Well, finger pointing today at New York Governor Elliot Spitzer, what a story. It has brought all this out for us to take a good look at it, and we appreciate each of you for helping us do that. Eugene O'Donnell at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And Juhu Tukral at the Urban Justice Center in New York City with the Sex Workers Project there. Juhu, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Melissa Farley in San Francisco at Prostitution Research and Education. Thank you, Ms. Farley.
Thanks.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.